So tonight I want to talk about it's quite a famous sutta. It's called the Samaditi Sutta, Sama, right view, the Sutta on right view, which is, the first step on the Eightfold Path. And so this is like beginning. Let's begin at the beginning, but it goes from the beginning and goes quite deep into the Buddhist teachings. And one thing I want to mention here, it's quite interesting. This is an example of a sutta where it's not the Buddha teaching, it's actually Sariputta, who was one of his principal disciples. And there are suttas like that in all through the different books of teachings, where you'll see particularly Sariputta, the most common one you'll see appearing to teach. And so in this case, there's a group of bhikkhus, and they're asking Sariputta. And here's what they have to say. One of right view is said, friends. In what way is the noble disciple one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma? Indeed, friend, we should come from far away to learn from the Venerable Sariputta the meaning of this statement. It would be good if the Venerable Sariputta would explain the meaning of this statement. Having heard it from him, the bhikkhus will remember it. Then, friends, listen and attend closely to what I have to say. So, this is setting up the story, as usual. And then he starts in a very unsurprising way. He says, when, friends, a noble disciple understands the unwholesome and the root of the unwholesome, and the wholesome and the root of the wholesome, in that way he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And he goes on and he basically lists the five things that we normally hear, the five precepts, when he's talking about ethical behavior, when he's talking about how to live a wholesome life. And this is where, the whole thing begins. And then he says, he asks this really interesting, and then the bhikkhus say, and what is the root of the unwholesome? Greed is the root of the unwholesome. Hate is the root of the unwholesome. Delusion is the root of the unwholesome. This is called the root of the unwholesome. So here's talking about the three poisons that we often see in the Buddha's teachings. And then he gives the opposite, which is what is the wholesome, which is the opposite of not doing those. And then Sariputta says this kind of interesting thing. When a noble disciple has thus understood the unwholesome and the root of the unwholesome, the wholesome and the root of the wholesome, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to view and conceit I am, and by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of view. So he's basically saying, if you can actually stop craving, aversion, and delusion, that's the definition of enlightenment, essentially. And that's something that, and when we're talking about right view, this means this is something we have to understand, but not on an intellectual level. On an intellectual level, it's like, well, that's interesting. It's not, we can all sit there and go, yeah, that sort of makes sense. But it's like understanding that some deeper intuitive level that's arisen out of practice, which is a different kind of understanding in a sense. But of course, the bhikkhus aren't satisfied with that. It's like, yeah, that's nice, they say, but, but, and then he goes on. So, good friend, the bhikkhus, delighted and rejoiced in your Venerable Sariputta's words. Then they asked him a further question. But friend, Might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma? He said, well, there might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands the nutriment, the origin of nutriment, the cessation of nutriment, and the way leading to the cessation of nutriment, and that way he is one of right view. So this introduces a whole new term in the Buddha's language that you come across from time to time, this idea, the word nutriment. And you think of what it is in the English language, what this means is like something, nutriment is something we feed ourselves with, right? But in the context of the Buddha's teaching, what he's getting at is that we feed our sense of a separate self. This is the root problem, is that we keep feeding our sense of a separate self. And we do this both, you know, on a physical level of, you know, identifying with this body as me being separate, but also on the more subtle mental levels. And the feeding is caused by craving, about wanting to be separate, because we somehow have the idea that that's going to be better. And basically, when we stop craving, we stop feeding this idea, because we keep thinking, if I just could have that, I would be okay. And that idea of having that is basically feeding a separate sense of self over and over and over again. But so why do we do this? Why is this like this pattern that we keep repeating over and over and over again? And it's because we think that somehow that nutriment, whatever it is, whether it's literally physical food or it's some thing or some idea or some philosophy or who knows, just something that we pray, that we cling to, we somehow think that that's going to make us happy. That if I just had that, if I could hold on to that, then I'd have a sense of being complete. That would fill me. This whatever this is going to fill me. Of course, this doesn't work because everything that, you know, we just get that thing. And then, of course, what happens is it goes away, like everything else. Things like everything else is all this nutriment is just something that arises. It's there for a while, and then it's gone. This is the inevitable pattern. And so we keep thinking this is going to satisfy us and make us feel better. And in the end, every time, it makes us feel worse. Because it goes away. And now we don't have it anymore, and now we're miserable because it's gone. Because we thought it was going to solve all our problems, whatever. And it's gone. Because that's the nature of everything. That's the nature of, you know, impermanence. So then, aha. So then this Sariputta says, when a noble disciple has thus understood nutriment, the origin of nutriment, the cessation of nutriment, and the way leading to the cessation of nutriment, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to greed. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to view and concede, I am. So he keeps this is a repetitive thing, right? In that way, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, has arrived at the true Dhamma. So, sorry, we're just saying, now if you just figure this out, then you're going to be okay. Of course. What the bhikkhus say is, yeah, that's great, but then they ask for a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, has arrived at this true Dhamma? Of course, Sariputta replies, well, there might be, friend. When, friends, a noble disciple understands suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, and that way he is one of right view. So now, Sariputta says, oh yeah, and by the way, you also have to have an intuitive understanding of what the Four Noble Truths mean. And this is, so it's now right deep in the Buddhist teachings, you know, because this is, all of the Buddhist teachings come and arise directly out of right view. And out of right view, which is sometimes called right understanding, and now you have to understand what the actual Four Noble Truths mean. Not once again in an intellectual sense, but in some sort of deeper intuitive sense. And I want to read some things that other people have said about this. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. Right view is the important first step on the path because it sets the direction. No matter how long or difficult our journey may be, if we're heading in the right direction and we keep going, we'll certainly reach the goal. If we don't know the right direction, then even strong aspiration and effort, we might wander for a long time and never reach our destination. The Buddha said that just as the dawn is the forerunner and precursor of the rising sun, so is right view the forerunner and precursor of the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths. So this is interesting, I think, because basically they're sort of both Joseph and the Buddha here are talking about how it ends, in a sense, how at the very end of our practice, because if you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's instructions in meditation, the very last instruction he gives is to understand the Four Noble Truths. So how come the end's coming at the beginning, so to speak? And here's what I've found over years of practice and talking to other people, they've discovered essentially the same thing. In this practice, and in the teachings of the Buddha to a certain extent, things aren't going in a straight line. What happens is we have a certain understanding, a certain sense of right understanding, a certain sense of right view, and that right view then leads us to form right intention and take some action. And then we practice, and as we practice, we start to see things a little bit more clearly, and sure enough, the whole teaching comes around in a spiral going through the Eightfold Path, and we're back to right view again. But now we have experience from practice that informs our understanding of right view, and we see things a little deeper, a little more firm understanding. It's less intellectual, it's more heart-centered, felt sense. And that gives us some energy, and we form more intention, and we practice some more, and sure enough, we come around again. And it's just like we keep spiraling around through the Eightfold Path, going deeper and deeper and deeper into the practice. I read this, I forget whose book this was. You know, often the image of people use for these sort of teachings is like we're climbing a mountain. You know, and you're sort of going up and you're going up and spiraling around the mountain till you get to the top. And what they said, I thought this was really interesting. No, actually, this practice is sort of like a pit mine. Have you ever seen a real pit mine? You know, where they dig down into the earth and they have this sort of road that sort of goes around the edge of the pit, and it goes deeper and it goes deeper and it goes deeper till it gets right to the very bottom of things. That's a much better image, because that's what we're doing. We're going deeper and deeper into the practice. But we keep going around that spiral, and we're going down deeper into the mine of knowledge. We're mining this knowledge through our practice until we get down right to the very center, and we go, oh, this is where we were headed all the time. We just couldn't see it because you're up here flying around up near the top. But we're actually working deeper and deeper into the practice and into the knowledge. We get more, we have better understanding, which forms a better intention. I want to read something else here. This is Ajahn Sumedho, and this is a book called The Mind and the Way. And he's actually talking about the fourth noble truth here. The fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path. The first of the eight factors in the path is right view, Samaditi, which is the name of the sutta, which develops from having seen and experienced cessation. To have right view requires that we be very mindful all the time. We must know that everything arises and passes away is not self, and this must be a direct experience and insight. Right view is based on direct, insightful knowing, not just thinking and believing in the concept. As long as you don't really know, but just think you know, you'll always be in a state of uncertainty and be confused. This is because intellectual knowing is based on symbols alone, not on direct experience of truth. The second factor on the path is right attitude or right intention. Once we have right view, then your intention from that moment on is towards nibbana or the uncreated, towards liberation. You still feel impulses and habitual tendencies like doubt, worry, or fear pulling you back into the sensory world, but you recognize these impulses now. You know them as they are, and you can no longer delude yourself for very long with those conditions. Before, you could get lost for weeks or end in depression and doubt and fear or in greed or various sorts. Once you've had that insight experience, there's right view, then there's right attitude. Because there is still a reluctance to put forth the effort to be enlightened, you might try to delude yourself, but you can only fool yourself for a little while. So once again, he's talking here about, you know, down near the bottom of that spiral where things are getting steep. But what he's saying is that's where we have to end up. But the important thing is that's where we're headed. It's not so much the destination, it's the route we're taking. We're spiraling down on this road into the pit mine. And, you know, I actually knew a guy who drove one of those big trucks. Crazy job. Anyhow, that's why I love the image, perhaps. But that's what we're doing. We're mining, and at the end, we come to what Ajahn Tomato is describing as right view. That's where we're headed towards. But this is a gradual process, and it's a little bit more right view, a little more right intention, a little more. We have a better understanding of the other steps on the Eightfold Path, our concentration becomes deeper, we become more mindful, and insights arise, and then, now I see something I didn't see before, and our view deepens. So then, now the sutta gets interesting. Because what happens now, and it's, I don't know if any of you read the sutta, I just got up to verse 19. The sutta goes on to verse 71. There's another, you know, 50 verses here. I'm not going to read them all because they all have this same pattern over and over and over again where Sariputta says something. He says, "That's it. Now you understand." And they go, and then the bhikkhus all go, "Yeah, but what about?" And so the next one here, just so I'll give you a little sample where they've done this again. And when friends, a noble disciple understands aging and death, the origin of aging and death, the cessation of aging and death, and the way leading to the cessation of aging and death, in that way he is one of right view and has arrived at the true Dhamma. And what is aging and death? What is the origin of aging and death? What is the cessation of aging and death? What is the way leading to the cessation of aging and death? The aging of the being of various orders of beings. Their old age, brokenness of teeth, grayness of hair, wrinkling of skin, decline of life, weakness of faculties, that is called aging. The passing of being out of various orders of beings, their passing away, dissolution, disappearance, dying, completion of time, dissolution of aggregates, laying down of the body, that is called death. So what is the arising With the arising of birth, there is the arising of aging and death. That's a pretty amazing statement. When you think about it, it's absolute. If you're born, it's guaranteed. With the arising, so what's the cause of aging and death? Birth. Oh, that's an interesting way to think about it. and he continues on in this vein, going through various answers that, because then they of course they say, well, what's the cause of birth, you know, and so on. And it goes through, and what actually Sariputta is doing is working backwards, or so I thought, through the 12 steps of codependent arising, which when I first read this sutta and studied it, I was going, why is he going backwards? You know, because usually, you know, you start at step one and you go to step 12. Well, he's starting at step 12. Everything dies. And he's going to work his way back through all of the steps of codependent arising to step one. And what he's trying to do is show that things we think of as one way are actually just caused by something. And that's why this teaching, which is a unique teaching of the Buddha, this 12 steps of codependent arising, basically it's always just something that can go either way. Because it's, you know, codependent arising means if A happens, B has to happen. And if B happens, it must be because A happened. They're codependent. There's no way out of this. This is if A happens, B, here comes B. And if B just happened, must be because A happened. And he's working his way back through. And he says, in this, he says, so I'm not going to sort of read all of this because it'll take most of the night if we started reading all 72 verses. But there's some really interesting. He says, what with the arising of birth, there is the arising of aging and death. With the cessation of birth, there is the cessation of aging and death. The way leading to the cessation of aging and death is the Eightfold Noble Path. And basically, he keeps repeating this over and over. Every time he gets to a factor and says, and the cessation of that is the Noble Eightfold Path. And basically, what he's saying is, all of these things are dependent on our understanding of the Four Noble Truths, which is where he started. And now he started there, and once you've got the understanding of the Four Noble Truths, then you can work your way back and see all the rest of this is based on, contingent on, understanding the Four Noble Truths. And then the next one is, with the arising of being, there's the arising of birth. So if birth causes, is the arising of birth brings about aging and death, well, what brings about birth is the arising of being. Whenever we have a sense of our separate self, we give birth to something that must eventually die, that death will cause us to suffer. So every time we create a sense of a separate self, we're giving birth to that sense of a separate self over and over and over and over and over again, by the way, like many times a day probably. But every one of those has to die because it's not true. But we keep doing it over and over and over again. We somehow keep thinking, this time I think I got it figured out. I really got to figure out this stuff. Yeah, I see. This is why. Yeah, I'm definitely separate. I can see this, and then falls apart. But we keep giving birth to that idea, and that birth causes is the root cause of the death of that idea, which causes suffering. This is where our suffering arises from giving birth to this idea over and over and over and over again. Then, of course, he says, well, what with the arising of clinging, there is the arising of being. This being, the sense of a separate, I be separate. There's the sense of being. And that thing arises from clinging to things. Now we're getting into the real meat of the steps in the story here. With the arising of clinging, there's an arising of being. When we try to hold on to anything, what we're trying to do is create a sense of a separate self. Anytime we cling to anything, this is mine. There's a me in there, right? There's a mine in there. That's my whatever. That's my Dharma talk. That's my car. That's my partner. That's my radish. Whatever it is, it doesn't make any difference. But as soon as we put a me and a mine or a my in there, that we're now clinging to that object, making it separate, mine, belongs to me. And that is how we create this sense of being over and over and over again. And then I just have a little note here. There are four kinds of clinging. This is a classic teaching. I've given talks on this, I'm sure. But basically, we cling to four things. We cling to sensual pleasures. We cling to views and opinions, which I've been a favorite group of mine. I gave a talk on that a little while ago. Clinging to rules and observances, like how things should be. And clinging to this doctrine of a sense of a separate self. That's what we cling to. Those are the four things we always end up clinging to. Now, what causes us to cling? With the arising of craving, there is the arising of clinging. So craving is like, oh, that'd be nice. Clinging is, I gotta have it. It's like, craving is now turned into something much more powerful and stronger. And it's like, I'm not just thinking it would be nice. Now I gotta have it. I'm going to cling to it and hold on to it really tight. So it's the next layer in this cycle. And this in the teachings here, he says there are six classes of craving. Craving for forms, craving for sounds, craving for odors, craving for flavors, craving for tangible physical experiences, and craving for mind objects. Oh, the six doors of perception, the six sense doors. Things, what we cling to are what arise at the sense doors. What a surprise. You know, because that's where we get that's where we find stuff that we want to cling to. And there's nothing else going on anyway. There's only things arising at the six sense doors. That's all that's ever going on. And that's what we crave, which leads us to cling to them. And then, where does craving arise? How do we get caught there over and over again? These are the bhikkhus keep asking. Yes, but what about this? Craving arises from what's called vedana, feeling tone. And so basically, whenever anything arises at any of the six sense doors, no matter what it is, whether it's a thought or a physical sensation or a taste or a smell, whatever, whenever something arises at one of the six sense doors, what immediately happens at the level of mind is something called vedana, which is generally translated as feeling tone. And basically, vedana has one of three valences. It's pleasant. I like that. So it's unpleasant, don't like that, or neutral, who cares? When it's pleasant, we want to hold on to it. We crave it in that way. When it's unpleasant, we crave getting rid of it. And when it's neutral, we crave something that isn't so neutral because neutral is really boring. So no matter what form of Vedana arises, the tendency is to crave for something else, something more. Either I want to have more of it, keep it, I want to get rid of it, or geez, just give me something that's interesting, please. That's how Vedana leads to feeling tone. So feeling tone arises from what's called contact. So whenever we have any contact at any level, at any of the sense doors, Vedana must arise. It's like hardwired into how the mind works. Now, this is a very subtle mental thing that arises, but it's always there, and it's separate from the contact itself. We somehow often get caught, and why this is so difficult to see, is we sort of associate the Vedana, the feeling tone, with the actual form of the contact itself. We think somehow that they're tied together. But if you look at it very closely, it's never true, because the Vedana is changing all the time based on causes and conditions that immediately preceded that contact. Just imagine, this is my favorite way of explaining this. Imagine I just offered you a bowl of your favorite thing. Doesn't matter what it is. It could be, you know, burritos, it could be broccoli, it could be Haagen-Dazs coffee ice cream. It's just whatever it is. Like, oh, wow, my favorite thing, that'd be great. And I give it to you, and you eat it, and you really enjoy it, right? So the Vedana seems like this thing I really like is always pleasant, we think, in our minds. We tie those two together. But then as soon as you finish that bowl, I give you another bowl, exactly the same stuff. Now eat this. Well, it's like my favorite thing, so I can probably eat it. But by the time you get to the end of that second bowl, it's pretty much like, oh, well, yeah, he gave it to me. I should eat it. I should be polite. You know, the feeling is now gone from pleasant to neutral. Same object, same favorite thing to eat, but the feeling tone is different now based on causes and conditions. Causes and conditions being that you already had one bowl of this and you're stuck eating this whole second bowl. And then as soon as you finish that second bowl, I give you a third bowl. And it's like, oh, God. Now it's unpleasant. Same object. But based on causes and conditions, I already ate two damn bowls of this stuff. And he wants me to eat a third bowl. You know, now it's unpleasant. Same object. So Vedana arises totally independent of the object itself. Here's the interesting thing, and this is where this all comes down to. When you think about that, like our whole experience in the world, our entire experience in the world is just made up of repeated contact at the various sense doors. You know, this is a classic teaching of the Buddha when he talks about this. You know, there's a place where he says, that's all there is. You know, if someone tried to say there was more going on than things arising at your six sense doors, they wouldn't know what they are talking about. In fact, I can see they would meet with vexation, I think was the actual phrase. they would try and explain, there's more going on than what's arising at the sense doors. And they'd be wrong. It's not true. All that's ever happening is things arising at the six sense doors. You can't change that. That's just sort of a definition of being a human being. That's what's always going on. And if we can't change it, we can't somehow live in a world where stuff isn't arising at my sixth sense doors anymore. What does that mean? Because it means that, sure enough, if stuff's arising, then Vedana is going to arise. And when Vedana arises, sure enough, I'm going to, crave. And then that crave is going to lead to clinging. And clinging is going to lead to creating a sense of a separate self. And that separate self is going to die, and I'm going to suffer. That's the cycle that we're going through over and over and over again. There's a few steps earlier on that are sort of more philosophical, but it all starts with ignorance, and then it leads to this point. But here's the interesting thing. Right view, when it comes right down to it, what right view is understanding that we can't change this. We can't change the fact that all that's ever happening is things arising at our sense doors. That's a given. We can't change it at all. So the only way out, the only way we have to work with this skillfully is to see if we can change the pattern of reaction. And the place to change that pattern of reaction, and the Buddha talks about this in lots of places, is at the level of Vedana. If we can start to see, if we can start to actually experience feeling tone arising, separate from the contact itself, as a separate mental arising, then we can go, we can sort of note pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and not react. Not fall into craving. Not go to the next step. Just stop it, the whole process, dead in its tracks, right at that point, where we just see the Vedana rise, we note the Vedana, and then now we just open our, we just open up, then then we note something, the next thing, whatever it is. That's the doorway that the Buddha discovered. This is the key thing he discovered in terms of how we can stop this inevitable cyclic pattern of just stuff happens and we react and then we make a being out of it and then we make it permanent and then it disappears and we suffer, which leads to more ignorance and around we go again. This is the way, this is the place, right here, at Vedana. The problem is, so often we've got that Vedana so deeply attached to the event, like my little example of getting your favorite bowl or something. We somehow got this idea in our mind that this is always going to be pleasant, this is always going to be unpleasant, this is always going to be neutral. And we just miss the Vedana completely. We're already off into craving before we even know it. As we practice and we get more skillful at letting the mind be stiller, this is when we start to actually be able to see Vedana arising. And when we can start seeing the Vedana itself, that's that place where we go, oh, that's what it was. That was pleasant. That was unpleasant. That was neutral. Without reacting. Without habitually falling into those patterns of reaction to the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral. This is theoretical. in some ways, very theoretical. But actually, it's in this intensely practical teaching. This is where we have to somehow, our mind has to become subtle enough that we can see this. This is when we understand this. This is the root of right understanding and right view. And so we have to, you know, form the intention to practice tuning into this. And it may be, you know, in our practice, you know, our daily practice, you know, once or twice in a half hour practice, we'll sort of notice, oh, that was fading. That it all just starts with something as simple as that. Just seeing that Vedana arose at all is like, oh, this is a good start. And then we start to learn, oh, Vedana, I don't need to follow. I don't have to react to that. Just because it's pleasant doesn't mean I have to want more. But it's a very gradual process of tuning into this. And then from that tuning in, it allows us to stop whipping around this cycle over and over and over again. This is, I think in some senses, in terms of the meditative practice itself, especially, you know, mindfulness practice, this is where we get led to this sense of being able to see Vedana itself as a separate mind moment from what arose, and then skillfully learn to not react to the Vedana. Yeah, this is an ambitious project. I have, of course, one other thing to read here. This is sort of tangentially related, shall we say. From Mary Oliver's book of poems called Evidence, and it's called Mysteries. Yes. And I think of Vedana as a great mystery. So it's sort of, that's why I like this. But I also happen to really like this poem. So. Mysteries, yes. Truly, we live with mysteries too marvelous to be understood. How grass can be nourishing in the mouths of lambs. How rivers and stones are forever in allegiance with gravity while we ourselves dream of rising. How two hands touch and the bonds will never be broken. How people come from delight or the scars of damage to the comfort of a poem. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who look and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. That's what we have to do. We have to be able to look and laugh in astonishment and bow our heads. Yeah, this is just the way things are. And I can see it. I can actually see it. That's what we're gradually, slowly moving towards, this understanding. I also like, let me keep my distance from those who think they have the answers. That includes me, by the way. I have to be very careful not to think I have the answers, or that all these wonderful books I have all the answers. I have to know this for myself. And I have moments of that, and I move towards that in my practice. But I'm just somewhere on that spiral going down into the pit. And maybe I'm one couple more layers down than some other people, but there's other people who are way down below me. I'm driving a smaller truck, maybe. I don't know how they got down there, but I'm working my way down. And that's all we can ever do. So it's like, we have to understand that this is just a practice, and this is what practice leads us to, is the looking at these sort of subtle things and going, oh, isn't that interesting? And this path of, you know, the 12 steps is a unique teaching of the Buddha that separates his teachings from pretty much everything else I've ever looked at. I've never seen anything like it in any of the other traditional teachings I've looked at. This is where the Buddha, because he really understood his mind and studied his mind and saw this, then he could explain it in the way he did. This is like the unique teaching of the Buddha that makes it all hang together somehow or other. So, as usual, all I have to say, I've either astonished you all or bored you all to tears, I'm not sure which. But I'm open now to questions, comments, thoughts. As always, you can just turn on your mic and say, share anything you want to share. But as I always say, don't feel at all obligated to say or do anything other than sit there and smile, which is always a good thing to do. Kathleen, go ahead.
So, you know, I was curious about, because I think that perhaps you did study a little bit of Hindu philosophy.
Yeah.
And so you're saying that this focusing on Vedana is a key difference?
Not so much focusing on Vedana, though there are, you do see that in a different sense in other philosophies. But this whole thing of the 12 steps of codependent arising, that particular teaching where one thing leads to another, and you can go backwards to it and see how this one, because this happened, this is what caused it, which is what Sariputta was doing in this teaching. He was going the opposite. You know, that teaching, the 12 steps of codependent arising, is totally unique to the Buddha. Mm. There's no equivalent of it in any other teaching I've come across. It's like this is one of the things that is so unique about the Buddha's teachings, is that he investigated his own mind and then expressed his understanding in this particular way that showed, A, how we just continually are looping around and causing ourselves to suffer some more, but here's this little doorway that you can open up and go through and not be caught in that loop anymore. And, you know, like I say, maybe we do a little bit, and then we do a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more. It's like we learn to tune into this slowly and not get caught in those patterns anymore.
Thanks, Barry.
Yeah, Carl, yeah, go ahead.
Thanks, Barry. The last part of this, when you went through the sequence, I really found it valuable. You know, I hear the word deathless all the time. And I think I understand it a little more clearly as in terms of this sequence metaphor, birth and death.
Mm-hmm.
As the birth is the birth of the self, and death is suffering.
Yeah.
And then the sequence before that, I'd never really seen it that way before. You know, you think of it as something exotic or some kind of awareness, but it's explaining it this way really helped me. And I thank you for that. Let me make sure that I understand Vedana. That's feeling, tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral.
Yeah.
Or is that the, okay.
That's the three valences, the three forms, and the only three it takes. The only three forms that Vedana can be is this sense, this flavor. I like the word flavor when I'm thinking about this. This flavor of what, of there's the thing that arose and this flavor arises that we notice and then react to.
So can you explain again what arises before this? It's just
Vedana is contact. Contact, which is basically something just happened at one of the six sense doors that we were aware of. You know, which requires that we're conscious of those things that are arising. I mean, literally, you know, there's another layer of this that I didn't go into, where the Buddha is talking about what's required before we're even aware that contact has occurred. And what has to happen is there has to be a functioning sense organ. There has to be something that's affecting that sense organ. And there has to be consciousness that's awake and aware that that's actually happening. And those three together make contact. And once there's contact, poof, there's the next thing.
So the Vedana comes out of consciousness.
Yeah. Consciousness and a functioning sense organ and something like a sound, like there's the waves floating through the air, there's my eardrum vibrating in a certain way, and my hearing consciousness are all required before that contact occurs. And then as soon as the contact occurs, right after that, Vedana follows. Because as we know, we can have two of those three. For instance, I could have a functioning ear and there's sound waves coming through the air, but I don't hear anything because I'm sort of focused someplace else. I used to drive my mother crazy. I was a big reader when I was a kid, and I'd be reading my books and stuff. And she'd say something like, Barry, supper's ready. And I wouldn't hear her. And she'd have to like repeat it a bit louder, three or four. Oh, okay, yeah, Ma, I'll be right there. I'll finish the paragraph, But it was like, because my hearing consciousness wasn't turned on. I had turned it off and I focused totally on what I was reading and imagining in my mind from what I was reading. So that's, and this is an understanding the Buddha has of that just because there's stuff going on, at the level of sound waves bouncing off our eardrum, doesn't mean that we hear anything. But doesn't mean the contact has occurred. It means because for contact, we have to have all three of those things happening at the same time. This is the step preceding contact in the 12 steps. So, but it is, that's the process. There's something happens that we're conscious of. Contact occurs, then Vedana occurs, and then off we go.
Thank
the
you,
beauty
Brian.
Of contact of Vedana is it's so simple. It's only, it can only be one of three things. It's also very subtle, which is why that's the side of it.
Thank you, Barry.
Okay, you're welcome, Carl. Okay. Let's just dedicate the merit of our practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.